I watched the Apple News election debate thing last week, Mayo, just to see what it was like. And this is one of those funny things where in 2007, I watched every debate every time one aired, and I had like a notebook with all the dates before I had something digital to do like a calendar with. And but this time is different, and so this is the first one that I've made sure to watch, and it was because it was the Apple News presidential Democratic primary presidential debate. And I was curious as to like what was the Apple News representation going to be like. And I tweeted about a bit of this stuff as it was going on, but it was like you got like an Apple News logo in the corner every few minutes. And there was one section where there was an Apple a question from Apple News, I think. And then there was
they had an ad.
Then they did an ad after every commercial break that was for News Plus, not for Apple News, and it wasn't even like really really good. It was kind of bad. Like
you like tweeted the ad or whatever, and it's the most lazy ad I think Apple's released in ages. Like, it's basically a PowerPoint presentation of just some like text flying across the screen. There's no, you know, there's barely any like actual video of anything. It was just like a recording of the screen and then some text flying about.
Yeah, and they've done a really good Apple News ad, I think, even for News Plus, because it was a News Plus ad for the subscription part. But that, I think that ad is like 3 minutes long, and they didn't cut it down or anything. They just did a whole new thing that was meant to be like, I don't know, I guess easy, but maybe poppy, but it wasn't great. It was kind of just like, it's really kind of lazy. It doesn't sell it very well. But anyway, like in terms of the debate stuff, what I found to be the most impactful part of all of this is that you could view it in the Apple News app when you would launch the story, and it was like a video player above an article, and that's how it was streamed from ABC in the Apple News app. But the best way to view it was not in the Apple News app if you're doing it from Apple, because you can do it like from ABC's app or from YouTube even. But if you go to Apple's TV app, then there were big tiles for it too as it was happening, and then you had a full screen view without an article below it, or you could do picture in picture that you couldn't do, I think, from the news app because of the way the player was made. So that was interesting. It was like, even though it was the Apple News debate, in some way, it was best in the TV app, of course.
It's a nice battle between how easy something is to use between the news app and the TV app.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a nice battle going on there of mediocre UIs.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's just a bit like music and TV, where there's video and everything, and well, but anyway.
Yeah, like live is something the TV app doesn't do very well, right? Like, if you go on the Apple TV, their current solution for like watching live channels is to just speak to Siri about it. It's like you hold down the microphone button and you say watch, and then you say a name of the channel, and they've got like 30 supported channels, and but you're just supposed to remember all the channels off the top of your head, and you just say watch and say the channel, and it launches the app with the channel running, which is a cool feature to have, but it really needs to be backed up by like a live program going.
It's like HomeKit before there was
a live tab, and then that would be the obvious place where you could put a banner for election coverage or whatever other stuff Apple's going to do. We've already seen them. I think they're going to do a lot more live stuff in the next few years. Zane Lowe was talking about doing a lot of live content for Apple Music, and we already saw them do they streamed the Billie Eilish show at Steve Jobs Theater at the end of last year. And again, that was kind of like buried in Apple Music, kind of. It was on the feature tab, but it'd be a lot better if they just had like a dedicated one-stop shop for live content in the TV app, and then they could just direct everyone there.
Yeah, right now they really rely on those tiles. But so I did that from the Apple TV, and it was just kind of neat to see like, how is this going? You know, this is the first time they've done this, and there'll be more, I believe, this election cycle. The other thing that's new, also election related, is that Siri now has a special integration with Apple News in the US, where Apple News has already had this election hub for 2020. And now, if you ask the right question in the right way at the right time, you can get election answers from Siri, which you could make a lot of jokes about that. We were trying this out before the show. You're in the UK, I'm in the US. It worked for me, depending on what I ask, some of the time. And when it works, it's a nice integration where you get the answer verbally and you get a nice visual from Apple News in front of you, and you can tap that to see more. But also, I would ask some of the questions that were promoted in this story that worked in this story, and they didn't work, you know, or they would work sometimes. So it's Siri. You know, what are you going to do, I guess?
Yeah, like, there are some domains where Siri's like natural language parsing is quite flexible, but this definitely didn't seem like one. This seemed almost, you know, rigidly you have to answer the exact questions in the exact syntax, or it's just gonna, you know, send you to the web. And in the UK, you didn't get any of it at all because, for whatever reason, they like sidle off all the election coverage for the US to only the US market, which is kind of sad because I think we mentioned this last week. But I'd love to be able to go in the news app and actually look at their, you know, custom election biographies and who's winning and all the data charts. Like, just because I'm not in the US, it's still interesting to look at sometimes.
Yeah. There's, one of the questions in the initial coverage is, it's kind of neat. It's like, who's winning the New Hampshire primaries? And so I guess you're supposed to ask that, like, in the moment as it's happening, like on election day or voting day in that primary or in that state. Some of the ones that worked for me, who is winning? You got at that point, you got the answer. Where or when is the Mississippi primary? I found for myself March 10, 2020. That was neat. When is the next primary? Nevada Democratic caucuses are on Saturday, February 22nd. So that's the next one. Who is winning the primary? Then they give you an answer. So yeah, it's neat. That'll be cool to use.
Yeah, and you get like a formatted table when it works. Mm-hmm. It's just the classic problem of you need to know the exact code phrase to actually be able to see it.
Yeah, and it is not so loose that it's like who's running for president and they're all going to be part of this. It'll be web results for a whole bunch of stuff, but it's a neat little thing that they're doing, you know.
And it's a good attempt, I'd say. It's spotty implementation.
Yes indeed. And it largely relies on visuals, so I don't know there's a big component for it for anything that doesn't have a screen on it, like the HomePod. Some other stuff going on. So this week there's a story that you covered where it seems like maybe you're going to be able to opt out of some emails soon from Apple, that if you get subscriptions and you get spam with those receipts, that you can. But did it work yet?
Well, it seems to work for some people and not others.
Okay. So the
subscription page in the iPhone is basically like a web view.
So yeah.
They didn't have this for a long time, and then last year they added like a more direct link to it. So you go settings, then you click your little face at the top for the Apple ID account, and then you click subscriptions. And then it brings up this panel where it shows you your active subscriptions, your expired subscriptions, and you can cancel or change plan from that screen. But that whole like interface is just like a web view in a wrapper.
Yeah.
And it was really clunky not so long ago. They've tuned up some of the animations and stuff more recently, so it looks slightly more native, but you can still tell if you try hard enough.
So it's meant to look like it's the settings app, but it's not like loading native. It's like loading over the internet.
Yeah, and it's like rendering like an actual website that's just designed to fake look like the settings app.
Okay.
It definitely could be implemented better. But anyway, what we found this week is they added a new toggle at the top for receive renewal receipts, and it's defaulted to on, which is the behavior that you've had all this time. So if you have a monthly subscription, when Apple bills your payment method, it sends you an email saying, let's just say Apple Arcade is charging you $4.99 this month. And then the next month, you get another email saying Apple Arcade is charging you $4.99. And you can times that email by however many active subscriptions you've got going through the in-app purchase system. And it can get quite annoying, right? Like, if you have 5 subscriptions on a monthly basis, that's 5 emails you get, like, 1 per week average, you know, and then you get them every single month forever. Now, there are some people who definitely like getting the emails because they like being reminded about exactly what they're spending, you know, exactly what they're spending, what they've signed up for, where they can act as a prompt to cancel if you don't use the service anymore. And so the setting is still defaulted to on, which is fine because that's how it's always worked. But if you do find the emails annoying, you can go in and you can switch it off. For me, the toggle just doesn't work. I don't know if it's because I'm on a beta or it just hasn't rolled out properly yet, but it's definitely worth for some people. But for me, I just like click the little green toggle and it just doesn't do anything. So it's a bit weird.
Yeah, I like the idea of this.
If you do get annoyed by that stuff, you can now turn it off.
Yeah, I like the idea of this, but I think that what I like the most is when you can do annual plans, especially when there's an incentive in the form of a discount, because then not only are you not having to keep up with a monthly charge, it's an annual charge, but also I do want the receipt, and so that fixes the spam problem versus this toggle. But my thinking on this was like, you know, I could see developers asking for this as they move to subscription models in the App Store more and more, that each receipt is like a reminder that you're paying still, and it's like an opportunity to stop paying if you want, you know, it can be that way. And so even though it's the default still on, that just giving customers the ability to turn those off helps customers and what they want, and then developers in that churn situation. So,
yeah, I mean, there's definitely a conspiracy theory or whatever where, you know, Apple would like you to turn this off because then more people like to forget that they're paying this stuff.
Mm.
And the churn rate definitely goes down if you're not getting notified every month that you're actually paying for something. But I think it's fine that it's an option. It's on by default. It'd be more slimy if it was off and you had to go.
It's like the new default, right? I need to go turn it back on.
Yeah, then it'd be a bit, I don't know about that one. And so, and if you do turn it off, you can still go and find your receipts if you go dig in the settings. There's like a page which just shows you every time Apple's billed you for something. So mm-hmm. you can actually go and find it if you really want to. Yeah, and kind of joining two stories together here, there were a couple of like funny little things that happened in the kind of Apple cultural world. One thing was that at the Oscars, there was the winner who was the screenwriter for Jojo Rabbit, Taika Waititi. He, in the press conference after he'd won, he made some joke. Basically, they were like asking about what the Writers Guild Union should do, which represents, you know, the screenwriters for films in America. And he clearly didn't want to like actually answer the question about what should the union do. So he came up with like this half joking on the spot complaint that they should campaign them to fix the Apple keyboards and complaining about like low travel and they're hard to write on. And there was a funny moment where he like tried to play to the room. It was like, who here uses a PC? And then like one person put their hand up, which is quite funny. He's like, you know what I'm talking about. Because obviously most PC keyboards do not have the really low travel that the butterfly keyboards have had. Right. And clearly he wasn't referring to the 16-inch MacBook Pro. Maybe he just hasn't tried it yet or he doesn't know about it, whatever. I'm sure Apple PR followed up with him because he's actually developing a TV Plus series at the moment.
Oh, great.
It's like a sci-fi series called Time Bandits, which I don't think has gone into like, they're not filming it yet. It's just in quote unquote development. So there's that thing, which was like some funny, you know, bad PR about the keyboards. And then also this week there was a bad PR because France issued a $27 million fine because of the iPhone performance, battery throttling stuff that happened across 2017, 2018. And obviously that resulted in the battery replacement program with the discounted rates. And Apple said at the end of 2018 that it put aside money for legal cases because he expected that some regions would take him to court over it and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the outcomes is this France fine. Now, $27 million isn't going to break the bank, but what's also slightly more annoying for Apple as a company is they've been forced to write this message on their website. So if you go to apple.com/fr/iPhone, so the French iPhone page, there's this pretty big banner at the very, very top, which basically says that Apple has agreed to this fine because they committed the offense of deceptive commercial practice by omission, basically saying they did not adequately tell users that they were bringing in the performance throttling system in 10.2.1. Because if you remember, this is a story that's quite a long time ago now, but when 10.2.1 originally came in, the release notes basically didn't mention it at all. And then like a week later, they added like a small mention to it of like the iOS system were now optimized to help reduce unexpected shutdowns. But then it wasn't until the end of the year when people actually realized the full consequences of what was going on there, the extreme throttling that would happen.
No, it was like
actually degraded.
On the web is where they showed up if you were already upgraded.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a big load of like turmoil out of that. And this is then the France fine, I think, is actually quite intelligent because it's specifically about not disclosing the system to users. So it wasn't give them, you know, adequate information and Apple agreed to the fine. And it's a $27 million fine, but it's a rather awkward thing they have to put on the website for like a month.
Yeah, it looks like if you took the fine print from the bottom of every web page on the internet and you shoved it at the top.
Yeah, it's like they've had to like force terms and conditions to the top of the page. It's definitely not what you'd prefer to have happen, but they agree to it, I guess. And if you kind of take both these stories together, it's just like a good example of thing of like controversies that happen in like our tech sphere, like actually have long-term repercussions in the real world, right? Like, yes, the keyboard is quote unquote fixed now for the 16-inch MacBook Pro, but it's not on the rest of the lineup. And even if it did come to the rest of the lineup, you'd still have people like Waititi and others still having the reputation of the keyboards being bad in their headspace, you know, even if it doesn't play out in reality anymore for years to come. And the same thing with the iPhone performance throttling situation. that thing has just refueled everyone's conspiracy theories that Apple slows down older iPhones on purpose, because when you dig into the details, obviously it's not true, and it's, you know, much more complicated and intricate reasoning behind it. But at the high level, you know, Apple is slowing down your phone. And so those myths, those ideas, they just swirl around, and it shows that, you know, when you're the biggest company in the world and you do have blunders, they do have, you know, long-term repercussions.
Yep. And from what I can tell, professionals use older hardware for a long, long time, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are people like, that miss the
whole... Do you remember for like last year, especially they had the behind the Mac videos, and they would always show like the old MacBook Pros, not with glowing logos and stuff, not the newer generations.
That's right, yeah. All right, this week Apple released a brand new app for the Mac called Swift Playgrounds, and... but it's not a brand new Mac in general from Apple, because it comes from the iPad a few years ago, 2016. What's Swift Playgrounds for the Mac, and why does it matter?
Yeah, so Swift Playgrounds for the Mac is basically a Catalyst port of the iPad app that's been around since Swift was introduced. Because they've always had the concept of playgrounds, but they've had playgrounds on... as part of Xcode on the Mac, and they've had Swift Playgrounds for the iPad.
And is Playgrounds, so I'm not a developer, you're a developer.
Yeah.
Is that you write code on the left side and you can run it on the right side and like see it play out?
Yeah, there are other ways to do that as well, like from like a command line interface and stuff, but at a high level, it's, if you can remember the original demo that Chris Natlin did in like 2015.
Who doesn't? Yeah.
Yeah. You type code on the left and you can preview it on the right.
Okay.
And that was like Xcode Playgrounds. And then what they did with Swift Playgrounds is take that interface to the iPad, but also add in integrated tutorials.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
So as well as just having like, you can start a blank project and type whatever you want, but you also get like follow along instructions. And that's what they use as the curriculum for like learning to code when they take them to schools and stuff.
Yes, yeah, so everyone can code. The curriculum for that is
yeah, exactly. So you can do like the first book is like a very basic move forward, move left, like functions, and you type them in and you can see a little like animated character move around this map, and it slowly builds up programming concepts over time. And then you, if you want to, you can stop using the kind of playground books, which are like the tutorials, and just go and make your own scripts and, you know, mess around.
Mm-hmm.
And the books were not on the Mac before. You could only view them on the iPad app. So Playgrounds on the Mac were just like you're on your own, really. Like the tutorials basically didn't exist on the Mac before. So you had all of this curriculum that was exclusive to the iPad. And Swift Playgrounds for the iPad is fine, but you know, you generally want to do a lot of typing. And yes, you can get a keyboard attachment for the iPad and stuff, but it'd be nice if you could do it on a laptop where you have more screen real estate for both, because obviously you're going to have two panes open of your code and the previewing stuff. And if you have the books, you then have this like third bit, which is like chapters and pages of the book, right? So if you can have more space and you can have a nicer keyboard, it'd be beneficial. And so out of the blue this week, Apple put Swift Playgrounds on the Mac. And it definitely helps bring parity to the curriculum. So if you are in a school that does have Macs instead of, you know, iPad distributions, you can still use the Everyone Can Code curriculum now, because you can open all of those books through the Swift Playgrounds for Mac application instead. It's probably Apple's like most ambitious Catalyst app that they've released so far, but I wouldn't really say it's like a step change in terms of Catalyst quality, right? Like, if you actually launch it, you can very quickly like get a feel for, it's basically an iPad app with a sidebar, right? Which is what we see on so many of these Mac Catalyst ports. You have this very iPad-y canvas, you have iPad like pop-ups and controls and editing. And then you have a sidebar, which kind of makes it look like a Mac app. But underneath, it's basically the iPad app. And it's definitely more richer than what you'd get with, like, Home or Voice Memos. Mm. Because just, like, Swift Playgrounds for iPad is quite ambitious. Like, it holds, like, a whole compiler and code editor, and it has to run the code, build the code. And the previews on the right don't have to just be, like, result values. In fact, the first tutorial book they go through is literally, it renders a full 3D environment on the right, and you just type in commands to move the character around. You don't actually like build up the full 3D world. You just build the, you just tell the thing how to move, and it like steps you through it. And if you go too far, it tells you to change and work around. So there's like this whole, it's definitely like the most biggest Catalyst app from Apple, right? But it still represents the same problems of Catalyst, or the same downsides of Catalyst, that you can expect from everything else. It's the iPad app loosely ported to the Mac. And what's kind of interesting is, because it is that way, not all Playground books that you can make on the iPad will run on the Mac app, which is kind of a shame, because you have like, on Playgrounds for iPad, you can do anything with Foundation UI kit, right? And you can bring those frameworks to the Mac through Catalyst, because UIKit is basically a Catalyst wrapper, right? And those will work fine. But there are some things, there are some like frameworks on the iOS that are not available in the Catalyst environment. One of them that's kind of obvious is like augmented reality stuff, right? Because the Mac doesn't have cameras. It doesn't have rear cameras. So you can't really do augmented reality features, which is fair enough, right? Because it's like a hardware limitation. Mm-hmm. So if you try and if you made, and this isn't just like some hypothetical scenario, on the iPad curriculum, they do loads of stuff with AR. Like Apple has loads of like AR demos through Swift Playgrounds and stuff. They want you to play around and put scenes in the environment because it's fun and interactive, especially for, you know, kids in a classroom. But that stuff just won't run on the Mac at all. And then if you go more in the weeds and you were trying to do like programming stuff, especially to do with like graphics, like lower level graphics frameworks, a lot of that stuff just isn't offered in Catalyst, and it's just kind of bad news. Like, so yes, they have brought the app to the Mac, but it's not like a one-to-one situation. There's still, you'll still have edge cases and like the AR example, where the canonical version is still the iPad app.
Yeah, so it's that they're, it's better because it's available more places now, and so on the Mac people will be able to use it that might not have been able to otherwise. But then there's still going to be spots where it's like, why doesn't this work the right way? And if you want the best version, it's still the iPad version. And
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's another consequence is, because it's running in the Catalyst environment, you don't have access to AppKit. You only have UIKit. So you're coding in the Mac Swift Playgrounds app, right? But you can't actually make Mac UI.
Yeah,
you can make iOS UI. So if you want to make like a window with controls in it that look like a Mac, you can't do it. You're making iOS screens, because what you have access to in the Catalyst environment is just the UIKit frameworks. So it's kind of awkward because of the way they've ported it. Like if they'd have made like a native Swift Playgrounds app, you definitely would have been able to do like stuff with AppKit instead, because there's some idea that like Xcode on the Mac is quite alienating to a lot of people, and it's hard to get into, right? And so having a simpler like code editing environment where you have tutorials is cool, but it's just another thing where it's like Apple doesn't care about Mac development, because what they're bringing to the Mac is a Swift Playgrounds introduction to coding app that can't actually do any native Mac stuff at all.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, I do see what you mean. Yeah, that's frustrating. It's like, and then you have to rewind all the way back to like the whole Catalyst Marzipan conversation, where it's like, you know, if you make a Mac app from scratch, it will definitely be better than if it were a port from the iPad. But would they ever make the Mac app from scratch? And in this case, man, probably not.
I think one place this will be used is if you're in a classroom.
Yeah.
Like the Apple student deployments, what they generally do is they give an iPad for every student, and then the teacher has an iPad and a Mac.
Yeah.
So you could see the teacher running through the demo connected to a Mac, which is connected to a big external display. Because they can also then, like, you know, the multi-window environment of the Mac is way more capable than the iPad can do when you're connected to, like, a projector and stuff, right? Because you could have the Swift Playgrounds full screen on the bigger screen, and then you could have the rest of your, like, curriculum notes, your lesson plan, all of that stuff on the local Mac screen. So that's definitely somewhere where it probably is going to be used, and that's probably the motivation for them doing it at all. it's not like the perfect solution for his, because it's hard, you know, because obviously it didn't exist before at all, but it does kind of fall short of like the perfect vision of what they could do for like an introductory, here's how to learn to code on the Mac.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Kylus is concerned, this app could get better in a lot of different ways. Some things will never be solved because it's things that are not on the Mac and don't make sense to be in the Mac. But as Kylus improves, this app could also improve. So could Apple's other Kylus apps. But is there an iPad app that you think, so you sort of push back on the notion that this shows that any app of any sort of power level can be a Mac app and with Kylus, but is there an app that you think that would be a good example of that?
I mean, I guess what I'm saying with Swift Playgrounds is that it is a pretty rich application, but it's a rich application on the iPad that's also rich on the Mac, right? Like it's, and if Swift Playgrounds was designed natively on the Mac, like as a native AppKit experience, it would look way different and it would behave way differently. There's you don't have to, you can click like one button in the app and you can immediately see like this is from an iOS world, and that's just the reality of Catalyst, right? So you're always going to have that bar. If you're thinking of stuff that like I think could translate really well, one example is the like the weather app, right? So the like I at least with the current state of what Catalyst can offer, I think the best experiences that can translate to the Mac are simple applications. So if you had weather on the iPhone and they made a iPad version of it, which by the way, they have cool UI that they could do on the iPad, because if you go to the Apple TV and you ask Siri to show the weather, they have like full screen 60:9 presentations of weather with the animations, with graphs that you don't get on the iPhone version. If they made that on the iPad and then they use Catalyst to bring that to the Mac, I actually think that would work really well, because you could have, you know, a sidebar for your different cities, and you could have toolbars, which would be like shortcuts to different actions. But at the end of the day, the core UI is going to be shared across all three, and it would just be like a waste of resources to make a native Mac weather. And so you could, and so to date, we haven't seen them do weather for the iPad at all. But if they have the incentive of, oh, they can make weather for the iPad and they could also deliver weather to the Mac at the same time, then maybe that'd be a way for them to do it.
And Apple hasn't said this, but isn't there Mark Gurman reporting that eventually it's iPhone, iPad, Mac, or is that?
Yeah, report pre them announcing any of this stuff, right, was that in the first year, it would be focused on porting iPad apps to the Mac. And then in the second year, they would let you port iPhone apps as well. That gets into the weeds a bit, because, like, what's the difference between an iPad and an iPhone app, really? Mm-hmm. Like, because you can make an iPad app look like an iPhone app, right? Like, you just give it, if you take an iPad app and you put it in a split view on the iPad, it will look like an iPhone app. So
a really tall one, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So the current Catalyst conversion definitely prefers you to have like a iPad sized window, like 4x3 window on the Mac screen. And you can kind of force it if you really want to look more like a portrait phone screen. But you could definitely see Apple like providing proper tooling to make that a thing. And then they could maybe do the calculator through Catalyst or something like that. And so that was what Mark said would happen in the second year. And then in the third year, they would homogenize the API so much that you wouldn't have to have... And this is quite technical, but at the moment, if you make something for the... If you make an iPad app and you take it to the Mac, there are differences in the code that are incompatible. So you can't just... Like say you're adding a toolbar to the Mac version, you have to write out a bunch of code, and then you have to basically like conditionally include it only for the Mac version, because it won't even build if you try and make it run on the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like a load of like, you don't have to make necessary separate files, but you have to make like if statements and blocks that are kind of a pain. And it basically means that when you make the final app, you have one compiled binary, which is your iPad app, and then you have one compiled binary, which is the Mac app, because they can't directly... You can't run the iPad binary directly on the Mac. Like, it has to be kind of like retranslated, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And so Mark's report said that by the third year, Apple would have got all of their ducks in a row so that all of the APIs worked in both places, so you wouldn't have to do the thing where you're basically producing multiple targets is like the technical word for it. You could literally just have one target, which is your entire code base, and it can run across all platforms. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of like the toolbar, maybe that would be exported to the iPad in some way, or maybe it would just be hidden on the iPad and it would only show on the Mac. But right now, you have to make like slight variations to your application to even build it, right? So when you the code that you submit to the Mac App Store for Catalyst is different to the iPad version. Even if you're including, like, you can't include your alterations to make it more Mac-like in your iPad version if they don't do anything at the moment. It just won't let you do it. So you have to do these kind of, like, hacky workarounds to, like, exclude blocks of code that don't apply in certain places. And so Mark's timeline, which Apple didn't confirm, obviously, but he got the year one nailed, was that by year three, you'd only have one binary with it all together. I've actually seen that confused in the last week with the stuff they announced last week, which was the unified purchasing stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So last week we talked about them allowing you to be able to buy an app on the phone and then it automatically pairing that with the Mac version and downloading that as well. That is technically different to the... So unified purchasing is different to unified binaries because the unified purchase is basically saying, we've seen you bought the iPhone version, so we'll let you download the Mac version as well. Whereas the binary would be like the underlying code that the developer wrote is identical when you download it to the iPad and when you download it to the Mac. And so they haven't accelerated the timeline or accelerated the rumor timeline. It's something they could have done all along. And now they've decided to do it in, you know, March 2020.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's quite technical, but yeah. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. And there's some things with Catalyst that we've had just kind of sitting around in the notes for a while. Like things that were sort of seen over the summer from Steve Trout and Smith, like the fact that there seems to be a messages app semi-built with Catalyst from iPad to Mac that would bring missing features over, the same thing for shortcuts, but those weren't there.
Yeah, you know, when you asked me earlier what would be a great thing for Apple to port, messages is like a great example that I didn't think off the top of my head. Like, the messages for Mac experience is, it's not very good. They clearly don't have the development resources to one-to-one match all the features of the iOS version, and so it lags behind. You could say the same thing for the Maps app, right? The Maps app doesn't have look around. It doesn't have indoor maps on the Mac, right? And the iOS and iPad versions have some of those features for years now, but for whatever reason, they don't have the development resources to recreate that all in native AppKit code. But those apps are not, they're not going to need so many like panels and toolbars and inspectors and all of this like Mac stuff to be good Mac apps.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, they can basically be single window experiences, right? With, you know, pop outs for separate chats or whatever. But at a basic level, you can see how they could translate them quite well, especially like you take the Maps app, like the Maps app on the Mac today is the map and then it's got a toolbar at the top. You could see how they could move the Maps app from the iPad to the Mac and just add a Mac toolbar at the top if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Like,
and then messages. There's so many features and messages that just aren't available on the Mac because of the dumb UIKit AppKit incompatibility. You've got the entire of the iMessage App Store. You've got all of the effects. Even the one effect that is implemented on the Mac is Invisible Ink, and it's terrible. Like, if you actually look at the quality of the Invisible Ink effect on the Mac, it looks like a Windows 1995 snow globe, whereas on the iOS version, it's a really nice particle effect. And even stuff like that, if they did a Catalyst version of messages on the Mac, all of that stuff would be aligned, and you would get the best experience because the best experience for doing iMessage is not on your Mac today. It's on your iPhone and your iPad. And Catalyst offers them a way to bring that to the Mac without having to have an entire separate team that they clearly don't want to dedicate resources towards otherwise. Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Unlock your productivity with Text Expander and manage everything that you type repetitively. Email addresses, phone numbers, message replies, and so much more. Turn the things you type into reusable snippets and access them time and time again. Text Expander works everywhere you type. Inside of word processors, email, messaging chat apps, even like online forms in Safari. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. Customize your reusable snippets with fill-in fields and pop-up lists. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. It's not just about automating repeat work. Reusing snippets ensures consistency in your messaging. Text Expander is available for macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. You can even sign up for free webinars that help you get up and running, including Power User Tips with David Sparks running through February. If you're a business owner, Text Expander for Teams lets you manage and share snippets across your company. Again, unlock your productivity with Text Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year's subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast. Thanks to Text Expander for sponsoring the show.
And maybe it's part of the thing is, like, at this time last year, I guess that we were kind of close to the rumors where we knew a lot of what to expect, but we haven't heard anything really about this summer, what we should see for WWDC yet, but that would
we're basically in the dark still.
Yeah. But that would be a cool one to come to expect, and it would be a big discussion too. It's like if the rumor was that Messages gets replaced with the iPad version on the Mac with Catalyst, then you could see people upset about the legacy things that would go away. But
like, because you can still do like legacy IM chatting messages, right? If you set up the account,
they've taken out so much stuff, but you can still do like, and you can invite someone to share your screen, or you can ask to share their screen or your screen, and you know, maybe they just do that. That'd be good on an iPad anyway. So maybe they find a way to do that anyway. But they have taken out a bunch of the stuff otherwise that used to be there one at a time. So there's not a lot anymore. But that'd be a cool rumor. We're not there yet. But
yeah, maybe. I mean, 99% of people would benefit from them porting the iPad version compared to the 1% of people that use screen sharing. And screen sharing would be a cool feature for them to offer on the iPad. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, if they actually did it, that'd be cool to have. But they haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't really need to be a messages only. Like, you wouldn't need to begin it from messages if it was part of iOS or if it's part of iPadOS. It could be like a control center thing, and then messages is one of the ways that you can communicate. Or I guess it would be Apple ID to Apple ID, but there's a lot of ways that they could fix that. But anything else on Catalyst and the Swift Playgrounds app for the Mac this week?
Yeah, I mean, it's good that it exists, and it definitely helps them bring the curriculum to more environments where there was this kind of like some people had iPads and other people had Macs, and it was kind of stupid that you could only do it from one of them. But I wouldn't call it like, I think people have got a bit like caught up in themselves because they've seen the keyboard shortcuts, the keyboard event stuff. They've seen the date picker changes. They've seen this, you know, quite capable Catalyst app from Apple. And it's like, you know, Apple is really listening. Like my core complaints with Catalyst, I don't think are ever going to be fixed. Like, I think that's just how Catalyst is, right? Like, in the longer term, the better option here is for developers to make like Swift UI apps with custom UI for each platform. And the Catalyst is like, and that's what saddens me about it. Like, it's never going to be the best experience. Mm-hmm. I think they could do an awful lot to make Catalyst apps better and more enjoyable. And especially like key events is a nice step forward there. But I don't think it will ever reach the point where you're like, let me put it this way. I think forever I'll be able to tell what's a Catalyst app and what isn't, like, in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't think you can make the system is just too constrained. So it's always going to feel like an iPad app running in like a window. Right? Like, and I like pure native Mac experiences. And
what about something like the Apple Podcast app? I'm not sure if you use that, but that's one where
I use Apple Podcasts on every platform. I can tell that podcast isn't native because you can like right click on stuff and it doesn't work the way that you'd expect it to. But podcasts is the closest to a native Mac app out of all the Catalyst apps that exist, mainly because it cheats and uses a load of stuff that isn't available to like everyone.
Mm.
So for like a really dumb example for Catalyst is the pixel scaling. So all Catalyst apps reduce the size of their canvas by 77% because like the default text size on iOS is like 16 points high and the default text size on the Mac is like 13 points, right? So Apple's like, how should we sort this out? Should we like have it dynamically change fonts? No, we'll just scale the entire window down by 77%. and then it will basically look like the text size on the Mac without a developer having to like change the fonts on the phone, on the iPad. So one consequence of that is, because it's not like an integer scale, it's like this weird 66% number. If you take the font looks slightly blurry. It's basically like the desktop modes. You know the default desktop mode on the MacBook Pro where it's using that scaled resolution?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, but for the window of the application. So if you look, if you don't have to, I mean, I can tell that immediately. But if you really want to see it, just drag the window to a non-Retina display and all Catalyst apps look really blurry. Like the text just looks terrible. Except for podcasts. Because in the podcast app, they use private API to make it still be at 100% scale. And they do other stuff like the segmented controls, like the widgets in the top right. They like skin them to look like Mac widgets. But they don't behave exactly like Mac widgets. So if you examine hard enough, you can tell they're not actually real. But they look closer than anything else that Apple's done, at least.
Hmm.
But yeah, I can still tell.
So yeah, I mean, there's things that I can tell from the podcast app, like just the way that a right click, it's gotten better, but selecting like groups of items or secondary clicking and some things don't behave the right way, or even resizing the sidebar. This may just be a bug, but it doesn't save. I want it to be narrower always, and it's always wider than it needs to be, and then I change it and it moves back. And there's just weird things that I think if it was like music, then it wouldn't be this weird. I think even like in the early days, like selecting all was a thing you couldn't do in a big list. And I think the last thing I landed on in using the app, which I do use all the time, is if there's a list of, like, if I add a new show and they're all, and I want to make them all listened, all played or unplayed, and they span across multiple years, then like Command A won't do the trick. You've got to shift click the first and last within 1 year, and then you can select those groups, but not across multiple years. And you certainly can't Command A and then right click. So, and I'm not a developer, but I have to imagine that's a Catalyst weirdness there going on that you don't see in any non-Catalyst apps.
Yeah, or just like that, it's not like built in. Like part of the AppKit experience is that so many of the behaviors are just like provided for you. So if you have a list and you press the Command A, like AppKit will automatically select everything, right? Whereas iOS has not been built from that paradigm of having a keyboard. Like keyboard support was added later, essentially. And so all this keyboard shortcut stuff is still very new. I mean, as we talked about last week, we literally only just got an API so you can know when the key is pressed down versus when it's pressed up, right? Like we're still in very like rudimentary levels. And so all of the iOS controls don't have the automatic behaviors like select and all. A developer has to like implement it all manually, which means most people don't bother, so it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense then. That's probably what's happening then there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like podcast is fine, but it'd still be better if they actually made like a native podcast app.
Yeah. It's so much better for me because I've long been an Apple Podcast user. For various reasons, like the ability to stream over the internet on the Apple Watch, you know, Siri integration before it was possible in other ways. And then having a Mac app as part of iTunes. And now that when it was part of iTunes, it was pretty rough.
The iTunes experience was garbage. So
it's way better than that.
But
that's such a low bar.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, yes, it's good that it's better than what we had before, but it still feels like they could do, you know, Apple as a company could do better if they cared enough, right? Like what you don't see is the opposite thing happening where Apple's making a framework where you can easily put a Mac app to the iPhone because it would be really bad. And Apple's core product is iOS. So you get the translation, the porting experience in the other direction. And, you know, it just makes me a little sad that that's what's happening. But the obvious counter argument is, would you rather it be a Catalyst app or would you rather it be like Electron or some web app in a wrapper? And I guess I'd pick Catalyst over that stuff.
Yeah, it's a hierarchy, right?
There's like four different versions of mediocre.
Yeah, Slack is weird. Skype is weird. There's lots of weird, bad ways to do apps. The third-party Catalyst app that I use the most have on my dock is Twitter. So I use TweetDeck to have a streaming timeline of tweets on the Mac. But for a lot of other stuff, I use the Twitter app and like the skinny column view, and I just open it up when I need it and close it when I don't need it. But the only, like, I would maybe look at using it instead of TweetDeck again, like I used to in the days before TweetBot and apps like that were harmed by Twitter limiting their API and not allowing streaming anymore for like your timeline to automatically refresh as soon as new tweets appear. But if Twitter put streaming pinned to top streaming where a new tweet is sent and it appears in your timeline without having to refresh, even on an interval, then I would be pretty happy with that, because that's my only complaint with the Twitter Catalyst app for Mac, not the fact that it's a Catalyst app. And they've slowly added things like touch bar support and then better touch bar support. It was really weak at first, and then they made it a little bit better. I'm happy with it. I think it's better than the web for sure. It's more capable than TweetDeck in terms of just like sending tweets. And
do you think it was better than the old Twitter for Mac app?
Yeah. Because it's got features that never came to the old Twitter for Mac app.
Yeah, but that's like a...
So it's complicated.
If you get all the polls and stuff.
Like, yeah, it's complicated, but it's like, you know...
I've used the Catalyst for Twitter for Mac, and my opinion is that the old Twitter for Mac was better.
Hmm.
Apart from, obviously, the fact that... And that's the thing all this time, isn't it? It's like, yeah, the old experience was better because it was native and richer. But that also meant that Twitter didn't update it with stuff like polling and group chat.
But you could also have
stream stuff.
You can also have a bad not Catalyst Mac app, like the last Twitter for Mac app. Remember the one that was updated, but it was just really bad before it got some work on it, but like it was just kind of janky. Like,
yeah. I mean, that's the problem. Like, in all these situations, you're basically arguing for like,
but those
Catalyst
are...
web app. That's basically your options in most of the third party. Like, and with the third party apps, I can excuse it more because they're third party companies.
Yeah.
For me, it's Apple, the company. I feel like they should be offering top tier experiences on their own apps. They don't. And to be fair, they have bad iOS apps as well. Like the TV app's bad on iOS. It's not, you know, it's not a port of anything. They just made it bad. So like that's where I come down. It's just kind of disappointing that we're kind of resigned to the Catalyst experience now for so many of like Apple's Mac applications.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about a few more things this week before we head off. The first thing is a new augmented reality feature. This is related to Quick Look and Shopping. What are the details here?
Yeah, so this is something that actually has been available since, I think, November or December. But Apple came out this week saying that all these different websites, like Home Depot, had adopted it.
Wayfair, like, Home Depot, right.
Yeah, loads of companies.
Yeah.
But basically, so you know the AR Quick Look thing, and you can do it with all of Apple's products, right?
What is AR Quick Look? That is, so it's augmented reality, and it's the thing where you, there's a product that you have, and you can tap a button that represents this is a special AR experience, and then you go into this view where the product is right in front of you, and you can interact, you can spin it around, you can zoom it in and out, but you see it as if it's like in your environment through your phone.
Yeah, and it's approximately sized to be the size it would be in real life.
Yeah, the most practical use of this that I've had is, like, it's fine to play with Apple products because they obviously do this. So you've got the Apple Watch, and it's like you can make a really huge one and make a joke out of it, or the Mac Pro and be like, hey, I've got this $10,000 computer right here. But when I was looking at the Peloton treadmill, it's big, and it uses this Quick Look feature, and so I use that to put it in the room that I was going to put the treadmill in. And at first I thought this is can't be right because it's just huge, but it actually was a really big treadmill, and it was pretty accurate. It wasn't 100% right, but I think it was like within like 5% from my eye of accuracy.
Yeah, and all these shopping websites that have adopted these AR object stuff, they all report like they have more conversions when people use the AR features. So the shopping website seems to love it. It's just a matter of time for them to convert all their products to actually have the USDC files and everything. What this new feature helps do is actually increase the conversions even further, because in the panel where you see the preview in the real world, the AR screen, right? Currently, it's just basically your full screen AR environment, and then you press close and you go back to the website. Well, what they're adding now is the section at the bottom of the screen is basically like a customizable banner where the website can put whatever it wants in there. So it can put like more details about the item, or it can put like an immediate buy button or an Apple Pay button. All of that stuff can just be put directly on the product. So you can put the product in your house, frame it up. Oh yeah, I really want to buy that. And then just press buy immediately from there. So it's removing a layer of friction where you'd have to like quit out of the AR experience to then go and, you know, continue with a normal website.
Yeah, that's cool. And one of the examples that they show with Home Depot, for example, is they've got a washer and dryer, and they show the new one in the environment where they're going to put it, and they have it sized the right way. And they're like, oh, this will work. And they even go as far as, so I guess it's just the integration and the whole stack of like Apple's different features and services, because they also show like talking to a Home Depot representative, like you're shopping over iMessage, like you mentioned.
The
like,
Apple business chat stuff.
Yeah, business chat. And like, it's you're using the familiar apps, but you're using them in a different way than just like going out on the web and shopping. You know, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's cool.
And this is probably the, I mean, they kind of demo shopping a lot as like an AR experience that everyone will use in like mainstream ways. And I think that's true for myself too, but not because there are so many competing ways. There aren't yet for me. This just happens to be one that you can try.
AR usage is probably low, but of AR usage, the AR quick look shopping stuff is probably quite a big proportion of it.
Yeah.
Because you're just, you know, scrolling your normal website and then you see a preview in your own home button and you just tap that and it just shows it to you. Like, it's a nice add-on. And it actually has some utility because you can see the physical size of the thing.
Yep. And just right in the name, quick look, it isn't like an AR game where you're holding up your iPad for a long time to play and you've got to, you know, look through the screen as the portal. It's quick look. You look at it, you size it up real quick, you know, you've got the idea, and you're done. You know, it's just to see, not to interact with it, really. So, yeah, it's a cool feature. So that makes sense that they're building onto that, and now you can enhance that. So I'll be looking for this in the wild. And, New ways to spend money, I guess, but it's neat. What's going on with iPhone rumors and everything this week? There's a few stories going around. Pricing, like, and DigiTimes and things.
There's a there was another report that said the iPhone SE 2 would be $399. We've talked about that like several times now, that they're basically copying the original iPhone SE 2 strategy, because that was $399 when it came out in 2016, and then the price eventually went down a bit, but it started at $399. So we're kind of looking forward to that, and everyone keeps saying it's coming in the spring, so maybe there'll be a March event, maybe they'll just do it on the website. Obviously, the coronavirus stuff is very common at the moment in the news. Apple's been closing stores, they've been reopening some, and then behind the scenes on the rumor mill side, everyone's loving to talk about the coronavirus and the impact of the supply chain, about how Apple has had to stop sending some of its engineers, because do you remember that story when it was like United Airlines was sending 50 Apple employees a day to China?
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently Apple's like paused that stuff, and that has consequences on product development. Although DigiTimes report says that whilst the final like hardware verification and validation steps for the iPhone 12 might be pushed back, it probably won't be so dire that Apple won't have to like delay the phone coming out. It might just be in lower quantities, or some models will be in like November time, which is not out of the ordinary, because they did the iPhone 10 in November, they did the iPhone 10R in the last week of October. So yes, clearly Apple like aims to try and get all their phones out in September, but we've seen, you know, slippages before to a couple of months later, and it seems like that might be what we're going to have this year. Apple's expected to do 4 iPhone models this year, and given the setbacks from the coronavirus stuff and all the factories not being, you know, operational, and the engineering not being able to send out there, we might see that some of those models don't all come out at the same time, or there might be like limited supply for a while or something like that. But at a high level, it's not like the iPhone 12 is going to be delayed till 2020. Well, essentially
what I say is pretty reasonable. You know, if we needed to go a year without a new iPhone, if that was what we had to do, it'd be all right.
Yeah, but of course for Apple's financials, it would be very bad.
Yes.
Like, you can see at a high level that I'm sure smaller companies get really affected by this kind of stuff. Obviously, Apple has problems with production, because if the factories aren't making the things, then they can't sell them. But in terms of, you know, product development, I'm sure Apple has enough money that they can pay to make these problems go away, right? They can set up isolated factories and isolated development. They can pay the Foxconn employees to come to the US for a time. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's complications, But I'm sure Apple has enough resources that they don't have to resort to just like delaying the iPhone 12 wholesale. They'll have mitigations they can. They probably have to spend more money than they would in a normal year, but I'm sure they can make it happen.
Hmm.
And then the other DigiTime story rolled in the mix here was about the A14 chip. And apparently Apple has ordered about 50% more A14 chips than the A13, which is quite a lot more. But Apple's also making 4 phones this year. And we expect there's going to be A14 iPads as well in the later in the year, which we didn't get last year, right? Because there's no iPad update last year.
So it's less of an indicator now of phone quantity than it would have been in previous years.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, it still implies some upside because 50% is quite a lot, and you know, Apple sells way more iPhones than iPads, so you wouldn't expect that to dominate, if you see what I mean. So I think it does imply some like aggressiveness as to Apple thinks that like 5G and the upgrades this year are going to be quite compelling. It's going to cause a big cycle of demand. What you also just have to take into account is that the iPhone 11 sold better than Apple expected anyway. So even if they ordered less initially, they had to actually up their orders later on.
Right.
So the 50% order isn't 50% of all of the orders that Apple has done so far.
It's going to knock some down.
The same period in last year, right? Mm-hmm. So if you take the 50% and they had to increase their orders by 15%, then you're already down to 30%. Then you add in 10% for the iPads, then you're like slightly up. And so it suggests that Apple is confident that the 5G cycle is going to cause a lot of upgrades. But it's not like as big as the headline number makes you immediately believe.
Okay. Anything else on the iPhone side this week?
I think that's about it. Everyone keeps there's so many like SE2 case leaks, SE2 names. Like that's just a product that's like so close to coming out that we're just kind of like waiting for it now. Right?
Yeah, it's not like a few years ago or a year ago, whenever it was, when it was like this. Maybe Kuo doesn't know about. Remember when it was like rumored from different analysts, but Ming-Chi Kuo, you know, reliable supply chain analyst, was like he had to at least acknowledge it in one report. Was like, it may come, but I'm not seeing that, you know.
Yeah,
it would be very minor if it did come, and then obviously it did not come. This seems like we're closer to that. And like,
yeah, now everyone's aligned, including Kuo,
and
the SE2 is imminent.
Yeah, and like you said, with the you know, event thing. They don't have to have an event for any of the stuff that's kind of floating out there right now, whether it's a different color of the Apple Watch, you know, in product red version, or if it's a different version of the Apple TV, a 13-inch MacBook Pro update with a new keyboard, or, you know, the cheaper iPhone, then all these things could just be released in different times. And it's probably, you know, the coronavirus thing is interesting because it's sad on one level because of what it is. And I would say that, you know, because that story is not going away, that would definitely have an effect on like what you do planning wise, because we saw just this week that Mobile World Congress, which is held in Barcelona, right? That's the big handset, you know, event of the year aside from Apple, but every other phone, you know, the vendor comes there to show off what they've got for the year, and that had to be canceled because a number of companies were pulling out of it, and then they needed to cancel the event because it wasn't safe to do. And there was some specifics that were interesting, like how they needed to do it to get their money, you know, for insurance to work out and for the country to declare it as an emergency. But it ended up happening where Mobile World Congress just won't happen this year. And so you could see if that happened, then you know a U.S. specific event might be different than an international event like that, but an Apple event is also, you know, it's also an international event held in the U.S. So
yeah, I mean, they invite people from all over the world.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out that being an actual factor in whether or not there's a spring event or just like a spring, you know,
press release
series of eventful days. Right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is 100% true, because none of these products are so revolutionary or incredible that they need to have that. They like, the trade-off is delaying the product launch to have a, you know, stage event for it versus just getting the product out sooner.
Yeah.
And so if they were on the cusp of releasing, you know, their first AR glasses, of course they would want stage time for that, and they would prioritize the event over it. But you know, the SE2, it's an iPhone 8 with a new chip, right? They can do a press release for it. It'll be as popular as it would be otherwise. Like, mm-hmm. they don't have to explain the narrative. They don't have to give you a reason to buy it, right? Like, it's a formulaic release. And everything we've seen for the Apple TV and even, you know, like the new colors of watches and spring band stuff, they can all be press releases. There's nothing that is like has to be event worthy, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, let's wrap up with a few more things here. So, John Siracusa has released another new app. I think we talked about the front and center app a few weeks ago, and this new app is called Switch Glass. And I think I get what it does. And these are all really interesting because it's that John Siracusa is a old school Mac guy, and as macOS Catalina is upon us, and it's the only thing that will run on the new Mac Pro, then 32-bit apps are no longer a thing. It's 64-bit only, and apps that he relied on that were 32-bit, like Drag Thing, can't work on the new Mac Pro. And so he needs to make utilities that make his Mac perform the way he preferred before, and that's where the app front and center came from, to change the way that window behavior works whenever you click on one window, whether it's just the single of that window or all of those windows come together. And Switch Glass seems, maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's like a second dock or an alternative dock, but it's just the apps that are running.
Yeah.
And not the apps that you might put there to launch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the dock without launching it. Well, launching from scratch is the dock, but only as a multitasker, and it's a secondary dock. So it's not your main dock, unless that's how you use it, I guess.
Yeah. Like it's kind of like if your dock could be empty and then it only showed you running apps.
Hmm. Yeah, which you could. I mean, you can empty out your dock.
Well, Finder and Trash can't be removed. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So you can almost get there, but you can't.
You can almost get there. Yeah. Okay. Well, neat. Yeah. I did, you know, buy it to try it and played around with just the way that you can make the dock look different, and you know, I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, and like I can see why. Because it kind of reminds me of the recently used apps thing,
yeah,
on, like the iPad and stuff. But the recently used is kind of annoying because it also shows the apps that aren't open, and mm-hmm. it messes with the order. Whereas with like the Switch Glass thing, it's like then you know they're not moving around constantly, and it's only the stuff that's actually open right now.
Yeah,
I actually think it's a cool idea. If I didn't use like a 15-inch laptop with a 25-inch screen, if I had more real estate, I'd probably. You know, use it more often, like actually use it. Mm-hmm. As it is, I can't, you know, I'm already spending what must be what, like 20% of my vertical height on the menu bar and on the dock. Like, you know, screen real estate is precious when you don't have a Pro Display XDR.
Yeah. I totally get what he's doing with these app releases, because it speaks to me that it's not, I don't even think it's like if it's better or more efficient or not, but it's just the way that your Mac, that you learned the Mac when you're, or, you know, for that matter, the iPad, in like your coming of age time. And so for me, there's all kind of things with the iPad, like the recent apps on the dock. And I'm like, it's not better for me. I'm turning that off. And now it's going to look the way it's going to work the way it always has worked. I have a lot of those things on the iPad and the Mac and the iPhone and the Apple Watch for that matter, where I liked the way it started out, and then I didn't really pick up with this change, so I always change the default to the old way. And that's what these apps are kind of about. It's like, you know, making that possible.
Yeah, and like on the iPad, you're kind of held to Apple offering you a way to turn the new stuff off.
Right.
Whereas on the Mac, it's flexible enough that, yes, you can make an alternative app switch if you really want to. And that's, you know, that kind of app couldn't exist on the iPad at all. But you can't, the Mac's open enough to let you do that.
Yep. All right, I have a few more things to mention at the end of the show, and if you hear the dogs outside, I'm just going to let it be since we're at the end here. But so one thing I want to do, two things I want to promote. The first thing is I went to a second NASA social where NASA invites people on social media to come to an event, just like traditional media, but just kind of for the exposure and to get to see something cool. And in this case, it was the State of NASA annual address, where they talk about kind of the NASA budget and what they're going to do for the next year and everything. And but I got to, and it was near where I live, so it was like 45 minutes away. But that was neat. But what I'm finding at going to these things is being around a different group of people than I otherwise would be, I guess. And that's the social part of it is like, last time what I picked up from it was that when you would talk about podcast, people would ask if your podcast is on Spotify, not if it's, you know, in Apple Podcasts or iTunes or whatever. And so it's like, I will now start taking Spotify more seriously when it comes to just, you know, any kind of podcast. Is your podcast in Spotify?
They've definitely grown a lot in the last year and a half.
Indeed. And it wasn't even just like Android folks, you know, because it could be that Spotify is like the Android podcast player, but it's I think it's also just putting podcasts in front of anybody. This time it was AirDrop as a verb. And this is just a group of people of all ages and backgrounds and everything. And it was this really diverse group of people. But we're all taking pictures and videos and everything. We want to kind of share with each other. And everyone, I never initiate this stuff when it, like, if it's more technical, I go from like the most basic way up. But for people to talk about like, you know, AirDrop me this, using it as a verb. And there was some like discovery of like, what is AirDrop? What are you talking about? And then they would show them and I would just watch. And it was just so neat to see like, you know, how this happens in the real world, I guess. And then there were a couple of people that didn't have iPhones that had Android phones. They're like, what are you talking about AirDrop? What is, and then they, oh, it's not an, you know, not an Android thing. Okay, that's too bad. But it was neat to see AirDrop as a verb and also just AirDrop used. And I've seen that before where like people, it's one of those things where I guess because it's inherently sharing between two people, then it gets shared like that, where if one person knows about it, they teach the other person. So there's a social aspect to AirDrop where just because it is a two-way thing, it gets shared in ways that maybe other features might not. So AirDrop is a verb. The other thing is, you know, my way of sharing from these things is like take pictures and listen and kind of learn and write like snippets of information to put with the picture that I'm sharing on Twitter or wherever. And there was a cartoonist from my home state, Mississippi, that was in attendance as well, named Marshall Ramsey. And I followed him already because I know that he uses the iPad to draw cartoons with the Apple Pencil, the iPad Pro 11-inch and the Apple Pencil, the second generation. And he had it with him here at the Space Center. And it was so cool seeing what he was doing because he was taking pictures. I'm not sure if it was with the iPhone and the iPad, but of what we were all seeing and also sharing like on our own feeds. But then he was using his cartoonist skills with the iPad and the Apple Pencil, and he was like annotating, just like this would be cool enough on its own, but he was annotating with what we would otherwise like caption the image with of what we were learning, but he would put it as part of the image. So it's like one picture and then it's self-contained with everything in it. Kind of like what Apple's marketing stuff looks like, you know, you take,
yeah, I was gonna say, it's literally like an Apple ad.
Yeah, exactly. But it was so effective. But then also he's a cartoonist, so he has this cartoon version of his dog Pip that he draws, and it's Pip in like an astronaut suit and everything. It's like, and then it puts the kind of cartoon aspect to it and introduces like some commentary there. And it was just so neat to see him with his iPad doing this in person. And it's, you know, I love seeing, like, for me and you, like, a lot of what we have to do to keep up with what Apple is doing is use our Apple products to follow Apple and talk about Apple. And it gets to, you know, it's like very, it's Apple all the way down. And it's always neat to see, and I know you do development work and I do other stuff too, but it's always neat to see how people are using their products that aren't just, you know, like inward facing.
Yeah. Like it can be very insular.
Yeah,
like.
Exactly. And it was really cool, you know, and I emailed him a few questions after, you know, the next day and asked him a few things. And, you know, like, you know, the biggest thing I took away was that I'd ask, you know, how would he share what we were seeing without the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil? And his answer was that he just wouldn't have drawn anything, you know, maybe he would just would have gone and attended, you know, but he wouldn't have drawn like this. And because like his regular thing is to draw a comic, you know, of one subject or topic or whatever. And that's the comic, that's the statement. But this is like a whole series of pictures and commentary and everything. And I thought it was just like perfect for what the iPad is all about. Unfortunately, the last question I asked him was, is there anything about drawing with a physical sketchbook that you'd like to see come to the iPad? And his answer was durability, like a sketchbook on the iPad, I guess without using a big bulky case, because he he dropped his iPad later that day, and it was like over $500 to replace. But I get that, but yeah, it's really cool. So check out the pictures if you haven't seen them yet. What the pictures are of is cool enough on its own, but then the way that he used these to share information, I thought was really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you would not be remiss to think like that doing that thing is only happens in an Apple advert, right?
Yeah, it's like commissioned
so
by
actually
Apple.
Having like concrete examples of people doing it for real is interesting, and they're not doing it as like a part of a marketing campaign where they've been like, you know, sponsored to do it or whatever. It's just on their own.
Yeah, it's not
being creative, essentially.
It's not like small print commissioned by Apple. It's like this is how he's doing. And I did ask him how long have you been drawing with the iPad, because he's a career cartoonist in this way, like, you know, the classic political cartoon. And you know, his answer, about a year. So it's like, you know, the iPad Pro has been out for longer than that. Like that version of the iPad Pro has been out for longer than he's been using it for this. And the way he did it was really cool. So check that out if you haven't seen it already. And then finally, my other podcast, Watch Time, has a new episode out this week. Every other week is when the shows come out. So this week, it's a little bit different. A lot of what we talk about on Watch Time is health and fitness related as it relates to the Apple Watch. This week, I had Matt Birchler from birchtree.me, his personal blog, on. And he does these amazing watchOS concepts every year where he looks at features that he wants to see on the Apple Watch and how they would be designed and how they would work. Like, for example, before we had an always on display, he had a really good concept of how that could work, where only certain things light up on the screen whenever you raise your wrist. And, you know, kind of like what we got, but what we got was even more impressive. But his watchOS 7 concept is really cool, and it was neat to talk to him about his experience with the Apple Watch and then sort of just what goes into all these concepts and how he even came up with the idea. So check out Watch Time on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you hear your podcast. And anything else you need this week, Mayo?
In case you can hear it, my voice, I do have a cold. It's not as interesting as the coronavirus. I think it's just a boring cold. But
that's for the best. I'm glad.
I do kind of wish that WatchOS 7 was out now, so I could use the rest days feature, because I've had to, like, just the not feeling very well and like the weird like shiveriness of my skin has meant I haven't actually worn the watch for 3 days now, which is kind of sad.
Oh,
but,
man,
I broke my activity streak. So
well,
that's what happens when you're ill.
That's okay. That's all right. Well, remember the rumor, like, WatchOS 6 medicine pills app? This is from Mark Gurman.
Yeah, it was like an app that would remind you if you had pills to take on a schedule.
Yeah, it's just all do that. I wonder if we'll see that this year. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac. That's ApolloZac. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at...
BZA Mayo.
So everyone tweet BZA Mayo well wishes and get well soon. I'm so glad that we weren't sick on the same week, because it would just be really sad. With that being said, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.